welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, delivering programs from radio's golden years. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Coming up in this hour, True History. Later on, the very talented storyteller, John Nesbitt, tells us the tale of Typhoid Mary. But right now, it's the first broadcast of the short-lived World War II series, The Doctor Fights. According to John Dunning, the series had two purposes. One, honoring the nation's 180,000 doctors, 60,000 of them who were overseas fighting in World War II. And the other was to raise awareness of the, at the time, little-known drug penicillin. Jackson Beck stars in this next broadcast from June 6, 1944, on CBS.
Shenley Laboratories presents The Doctor Fights, starring Lieutenant Commander Robert Montgomery, United States Naval Reserve, in a thrilling true story of a doctor in World War II. The Doctor Fights. Starring Robert Montgomery.
The eternal providence has appointed me to watch over the life and death of all thy creatures. May I always see in the patient a fellow creature in pain. Grant me strength and opportunity always to extend the domain of my craft.
This is the prayer of every doctor. It is ages old, and yet today it is as new as the heroism of tomorrow's battle. This is a doctor at war. Shenley Laboratories voiced the wish of all America that victory in the Pacific soon will be ours. When that day comes, this war will end for most of the men fighting today. But for some of those now serving on the battlefront, their fight will never end. These men are America's physicians, for whom the battle against disease goes on endlessly. No development in recent medical history has given the doctor such aid in his fight, both in war and civilian use, as penicillin. The story of how this drug, so difficult to prepare in quantity, was first produced in sufficient amount for the Army and Navy, and then finally in quantity enough for most civilian needs, is a tribute to the 22 great industrial companies who turned their facilities to the demanding task of penicillin production. Shenley Laboratories is indeed proud to have been among those firms permitted to produce penicillin. Tonight, Mare Island and Back is the true story of Captain Henry H. Kessler, the man who has done so much to return seriously wounded men to a normal, happy life. We will meet Captain Kessler in person later in our program. And now, The Doctor Fights, starring Robert Montgomery.
Hear this, you blessed ones, you lucky ones sitting in your bedrooms with 10 pink toenails to clip, and you in your kitchens opening a bottle with two living hands. Now hear this, and you especially who sit by the loudspeakers and smoke, having but recently learned how to open a pack of cigarettes with one hand. Hear this. This is Sam Logan's story, Captain Sam Logan, United States Marine. He was feeling good that morning. Plenty of sky over Guadalcanal, and the smoke of the guns didn't come up this high. Might have been Florida below. It was so clean up here. And the clouds washed his wings as he banked left to circle the island. This was the life. This was the joy of it. This was Sam Logan's life, the beginning and the end of it. To wish for a cloud and be there. To yearn for higher air and climate on the hot back of an engine. Leveling off now, he dipped a wing to the boys below to show them he was there with his big hand over them. And then he saw the sun and saw the speck on it and grinned like a boy. And the clouds moved under to make a floor he could fight on. It came like a black stone, growing, sprouting wings now, firing now. The sun like a mirror shining in his eyes. Something went past. He banked hard right, the strong right leg on the pedal. The hatch opened hard with the wind sucking. Horizon over his left ear now. The wind on his head like a hammer as he stands on his seat and walks out and slides down the sky. One, two, three, four. Sam Logan gripped the steel handle at his chest. Eight, nine. His shoulders jerked and he grinned again. Far below, he saw the sea between his legs like a great pillow. And then it came. The Zero turning back, nosing up toward him, the sun flashing like water on the prop. Angry, squirming upward like a snake. Sam Logan hung from his parachute, and the Japanese pilot, husbanding his Imperial cartridges, performed a successful but unnecessary amputation 2,000 feet above the sea. And Sam Logan's right leg flew in a high and bloody arc and followed him down, while the Zero, propeller dripping, moved northward toward Japan.
But consider yourself lucky, Logan.
Yeah?
Sure. Take little Henry here. I wasn't even supposed to be out here. I had too many independents. Wife and two kids. Had it all figured. I'm safe. All right, so I'm in. I figure, well, I get myself in the band. No violins allowed. Quartermaster. I ain't fat enough. Air corps. Too fat. Landing barges? Just right. When we get back in the States, I'm going to get up in the morning, my kids tie my shoes, my wife puts on my hat, and I go sell my apples. Plus, you're for the intersection of 42nd and Broadway, Logan. Or are you going to corner the Macintosh market?
That doctor said he'd put a hand on you, didn't he?
You can't tie your shoes with a hook. What are you going to do? Give it any thought?
I don't know. I want to see that doctor. What's his name? Kessler?
He's nice, that doctor, but he can't grow you nothing you can put a shoe on.
Well, at least we only got one missing, Luke.
Yeah, which just about puts me right behind the eight ball. Man, I heard the way you lost your that shoe.
I didn't lose it. I gave it.
Yeah? Well, whatever you did, you ain't got it, bud.
What'd you do, Luke? Farmer?
Yeah, that's all I ever did. And there ain't no corner to sell apples on in Clay County.
I heard those artificial legs are pretty good the way they got them down.
Yeah, but I ain't pitching no artificial hay. And I ain't plowing no artificial ground, neither. It's tough enough with two legs. I just hope to God they never let me out of this hospital. That's all I hope.
Here's Dr. Kessler, Logan.
Morning, boys.
Morning,
doctor.
Hot in here, isn't it? Ah, that's better. Some of that new Hebrides ozone. Why didn't you open that window next to your chair, Henry?
I can't open that window. Needs two hands.
It'll open with one and a half. Try it. Let's see it, Henry.
There it is. What there is of it.
Oh, it looks nice.
Pretty.
Could have been worse, Henry.
I know. Every morning I thank God it wasn't my head.
What head? Henry, when you get back to the States, they'll do a fancy operation on you. Fix you up with a hand that you can open and close just by thinking. You won't have to move your shoulders to operate it. It works right off your own muscles. No, all you have to do is to learn how to think.
That's great, Doctor.
Now, look here.
I appreciate it, Doctor, but you don't have to kid me. I'm a truck driver. 10-ton max. How am I going to drive a truck with a tin hand?
You can do it with a tin hand, but you can't do it with a tin brain.
I appreciate it, Doctor. But I ain't kidding myself.
Okay. It's your funeral. Luke, take that cover off. Let me see the leg.
It don't hurt anymore, sir. Hardly.
Well, no reason why it should. Yeah. Looks fine. Cover up. Tell me, boy, you got the farm waiting for you back home, haven't you?
I can't go back to that farm, sir. They can't afford to feed me.
Why, you tired of working?
Oh, no, sir, but I can't...
I'll talk to you about it later. Let's see it, Logan.
Feels peculiar.
Raise it.
Feels funny. How's it look?
All right. Cover up. Move over. Let me sit on your bed.
How am I doing? Is it healing, sir?
Yes, coming together in great shape. I've been wanting to talk to you, Logan. What are your plans?
Plans for what?
They'll fit you with an artificial leg back in the States. The thing I'm interested in is the kind of work that you want to do. Maybe you can get started on it in the hospital, and by the time you're a civilian...
Oh, well, I'm going to fly, sir.
You're going to fly?
That's right.
That's a pretty damn nice way of taking it, Logan. I'm glad you feel that way.
How long will it take for me to get a leg?
Oh, a few months. You'll have plenty of time to get used to it, and then, I don't know, maybe a commercial line will give you a chance.
Well, I'm not interested in commercial flying. I'm going back into combat.
I see. Did you ever know anybody with an artificial leg?
No, but I know what you mean, sir, but it doesn't apply to me. I'll be able to walk, won't I?
Definitely.
Well, if I walk, I can fly. And if I can fly, I can fly combat.
All right. I don't think it's ever been done in this man's Navy, but who knows? Maybe nobody tried. I'll see you later, Logan. See you later, boys. That was Sam Logan. Of course, he'd never fly, certainly not for Navy combat. In the beginning, I berated myself for not telling him the truth, and every day I made up my mind to tell him. But it kept getting harder and harder. I'd come into the ward, and he'd be smiling up at me with that kid grin on his face, and whenever we'd talk...
You know, when I get a plane, Doctor, I'm going to take you up and turn you over so many times you'll think you drank a gallon of high octane. I'll show you a power dive like you never...
And another time, when we were alone...
I was just reading about these jet propulsion jobs. Man, that's for me. They'll never touch us in those babies. 700...
One day I went out to the field. It was a few miles from the hospital. I knew a major there. We were old friends.
That's right, Captain. This is the kind of fighter he was flying.
Yeah, well, I'd like to look in the cockpit.
Well, here, step right up. There you are, now hoist in. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to feel these pedals. How far does this pedal go?
Oh, go ahead and press it.
Uh-huh. Major, I want your opinion. What would you say to a man flying one of these in combat with one artificial leg?
Impossible.
Now, wait a minute. He's got the action of his knee. It's just from the knee down.
Couldn't do it. I doubt that he'll fly, and he'd certainly never make combat.
He's a remarkable kid, Major. He's all guts.
That wouldn't help, Captain. I'm not a doctor. I'm a flyer. But I don't believe that a man is ever going to time the use of an artificial leg so that he can go into combat and come out alive. That leg's got to respond, Captain. A man's got to act on the split tail of a
second. Is
there
any rule against it that you know of?
Well, there isn't any rule against a blind man flying either. But we don't give them airplanes.
But there's no rule.
No. No, but it just won't work. I wouldn't let him kid himself, Captain. He's got all the flying medals he's ever going to get.
Yeah, get your Macintoshes all red, all right. Five apiece, help the veteran, yeah. How's that, Fennel Logan?
Great. Henry, why don't you shut up?
What do you mean? Dr. Kessler says you should practice up on what you're going to be in life. I'm doing my occupational therapy.
We're going back to the States today. Buck up, old boy. Free ocean cruise.
You know, Luke, I think his mother must have been thinking of Santa Claus.
Boy, I sure hope they don't put me out of the hospital. That's all I hope.
Hello, Doctor. When are we leaving?
Hi. About an hour. Get out of here, will you, boys? I want to talk to Logan. Go ahead, Henry. Give Luke a push.
Yeah. Hey, don't you think we make a great pair, Doctor? He could carry the pencils and the tin cup, and I push him.
Oh, shut up.
You're breaking my heart. Get out of here. You're going to Mare Island Hospital, Logan, California.
Swell. I heard about that place.
I won't be with you for a while, so I want to tell you a few things. First of all, I'm not sure that you'll ever fly again.
No, sir, I've got to fly.
Wait a minute now. You see, Luke and Henry here, they've made up their minds that they can't do anything. That's a bad attitude, obviously. But it's just as bad for a man to think that he can do everything.
If I can't fly, I might as well be dead.
Now, you cut that out.
No, sir, that's the way I feel. I was just getting hot. I was just getting good.
Tell me this. Before you started to think about flying, what were you interested in?
Nothing.
Oh, come on now.
When I was 6 or 7 years old, my dad drove us out to the flying field. You know where they took you up for a dollar? Well, when I saw one of those planes go up, that's when I knew. And I never changed. Not for 5 minutes.
Good enough. Now listen to me. Supposing I were God, God of the Navy and the Marines.
Would you have trouble?
Oh, you said it. But just supposing I had the power to put you in a plane and send you into combat, and you got in and took off, and after 5 minutes in the air, you realized that you couldn't make it. You came down, and... You see what I mean? I want you to have something to fall back on, an ace in the hole.
I realize what you're saying, sir.
I don't want you to think that it's completely out.
I know what you want me to think. I'd just like to tell you something, sir. You deal with hundreds of crippled men every week. And maybe after a while, you begin to look at them as though they felt crippled.
What do you mean?
I sit here looking out of this window, and I see the sky, and I see the planes going over, and I feel like Sam Logan, that's all. The same way I ever felt when I saw planes flying. I look different, but I feel the same. And I hope to God they're going to treat me in the States the way I feel. Not the way I look.
You think I've treated you that way?
You've been all right, but I still don't think you realize what a man can do if he's got to do it.
You know, it's funny. Ever since I became a surgeon, I've been trying to make patients understand just that.
Then you believe that I can fly combat again. You do, don't you?
Officially? No. Medically? No. But, well, I'm an official and I'm a medic. So, good luck to you, Sam.
I'll be back, and when I fly over here, I'll buzz you at 50 feet.
You do that, boy. Goodbye. Doesn't happen this way very often, but it did this time. Sam Logan left the Hebrides with Henry and Luke, and a little while later I followed. When I saw the lovely coast and the boys crowding the rail, I caught the longing in their eyes. I remembered Sam Logan's eyes, and as we docked, I felt that I must either do something that was impossible, or Logan was going to have to do it. And that's how it was when I sat with him and the boys in the warm Mare Island sun.
Am I glad to see you, Doctor? They got me marked nuts around here.
Good judge is a character. Let me see that leg.
Yeah. I bumped into a captain I knew in the Pacific, and he says any time I want, I can come out to the field, and he'll give me a plane to take up.
You don't say.
Yeah. I got Henry and Luke working for me, too. Henry's... Here he comes now. Hey, Henry, come over here.
Yeah.
There's Luke, too. Luke, come here.
Oh, Doctor.
Hi.
How you doing, huh?
Hey, Doctor, I was just talking to a nice.
Oh, Doctor.
Pull up, Luke.
This nice has got an uncle who worked in the Admiral's office, and she's going to tell him to put in a word for Sammy here to get a plane when he's ready.
Only thing, she says you got to put the okay on him first.
Well, you're paying these fellas, Logan.
I promised to name my plane Henry and Luke.
And when I get a Mac again, I'm going to paint Sammy over the radiator.
When did you change your mind about truck driving?
Huh? I didn't change my mind. I just figured if Sam can fly an airplane with one leg, I can drive a truck with a tin hand anyhow. I mean, he ain't that good.
They're both crazy, Doctor. Why don't you tell them what's going on?
How about you, Luke? You make any arrangements at home?
Well, my old man keeps writing when I'm coming. But I discourage him. Man that eats and don't work. People ain't going to like him after a while. I ain't going to get myself into none of that.
How about it, Doctor, huh? We get another operation, don't we?
Well, here's the story. You got a lot of work on your arm, Henry, and we'll start right away. There's just one more surgery for you, Sam, and another session for you, Luke. When I get you all fitted up, we'll start walking. Up and down stairs, and climb some ladders. Put you in a car, Henry, and start you driving. Maybe some horseback riding and so on. And while this is all going on, Sam, I want you to do some thinking about your future. I understand there's a lot of good jobs in the local aircraft plant.
No, sir, I'm going
to fly. I'll do the best job I know how to do, Sam. You'll be able to do anything that you want to do in civilian life, and there'll be plenty of jobs in the Marines for you.
Sharpening pencils, you mean?
I mean, there'll be plenty of jobs. Now, you think about it.
You didn't say this in the Hebrides, Doctor.
I hoped you'd come to realize it yourself. I can only make you walk. I can't think for you, Sam. And you're not thinking.
Oh, no. He thinks all the time, Doctor.
I'm working over Tokyo day and night. It'll be over soon. I didn't finish what I was supposed to do. I got to finish. I want to finish it.
Don't you see how impossible it is? Even with bad teeth, a man can't get into the Air Force. How in the world...
I don't care. I got to do it.
He's got very good teeth, Doctor.
Oh. Well, I'll operate this afternoon. You'll be ready at 4:00.
time, Sam Logan was walking, and so was Luke. And Henry was picking up magazines with his new hand. It's no good to put romance into this. It's not right to forget the sadness in this. But they were walking. And Henry was tying his shoes. In fact, he was going around tying everybody's shoes who would let him. And I noticed he forgot about the apple business. And then the thing happened. The thing that always happens.
Hey, Sam, give me a hand here. Hey, Luke, come on, get up.
Come on, Buttertoes, get up. What, are you lazy again?
I can't do it.
Oh, baloney, you're just lazy again. Up, come on, up.
Yeah, that's it. There, sit him here. Yeah. That's it. Sit down, Luke. What are you trying to pick up cigarette butts for?
Shut out. Let me alone, will you?
Come on, Luke, we're going for a walk.
I ain't walking no more. Staying right here. I ain't getting up again.
We're going horseback riding next week. You got to get in trim.
I ain't getting in no trim here. Ain't gonna make no damn fool out of me. I'm sitting here, and I'm gonna keep right on sitting here.
You know what you're gonna do? You're going to disgrace Dr. Kessler. Look at that nice work he did on you. You wanna go and disgrace the doctor? Oh, Luke, come on, open your eyes. Open your eyes, get on your feet. Sam, you talk. Sam? Where did he go now?
Oh, there you are, boys. I'd like to talk to you.
Ah, hiya.
What's on your mind, Doctor?
Well, I was planning some things for the three of you next week. You feel up to it?
Oh,
sure.
Why not?
Boy, look at that plane. That's the same plane I was flying. Look at her tear. Look at her. Heading west, too. When am I going to fly, Doctor?
You want to get yourself killed? Sam, you crazy.
Doctor, please. Give me a chance. One chance. Get me into a training plane, anything. I'll tell you if I can't do it. I swear I'll tell you.
All right, Sam.
Doctor, you're not kidding now.
I have a light plastic leg I want to fit you with first. Then you'll get used to that and we'll see what we can do. I'm not guaranteeing the Navy is going to give you a plane now.
But you'll tell them I can fly.
I can only tell them what I know, boy. I know that you want to fly. And I don't know any reason why you shouldn't. The rest is up to them.
Hey, and when do I get a car to drive, Doctor?
I'll let you know when you're ready, Henry. Well, what do you say, Luke?
I'll wait, Doctor. I'll just wait.
It's all set, sir. Sorry you can't come along.
Well, I'd just like to stick my head in for a minute, Lieutenant.
I'll get right up on the wing, sir.
Oh, thanks. I got it. It's all yours now, Sam. How's the leg feel?
Just like my own. Don't worry about anything, Doctor. I'll be all right. And say, Doctor.
Yeah?
I never thanked you for everything. I'd like to thank you.
One look at that puss of yours now is enough for me. Let's see you fly, Sam.
Step aside, mister.
And remember, fly over the hospital. The boys will all be out watching for you.
I'll be there in 5 minutes. Make way.
One is from New York. Part of it says, I knew I'd get mixed up with apples one way or another. I'm delivering them from upstate in a 10-ton Mack. The hand steers fine. You were right. All I gotta do is think, and it opens and closes. And I know how to think now. Any news from Sam, the flying man? Signed, Henry. The second is from Clay County. My son Luke, it says, is out hoeing now. So I'm taking this opportunity to say that he still feels embarrassed about the trouble he was to you. But is fine and works good. Keeps wondering about a boy name of Logan. And his mother and myself are wondering how he made out finally. Our thanks to you for Luke.
And the third letter is from somewhere in the Pacific. Just a quick one, it says, to let you know I am now Major Logan. Hope you're still at Mare Island when I get back, because you're not getting out of that ride, I promise you. Button up, Doctor, I'm coming. And the way it looks out here, it'll be soon. P.S. I wrote your name on the leg, just in case I start forgetting who put me back in the clouds. It's signed, Sam. Ladies and gentlemen, from San Francisco, we now present Captain Henry H. Kessler himself, director of the Rehabilitation Division of the Naval Hospital at Mare Island. Dr. Kessler will be interviewed by Grant Holcomb.
You must have many stories, Captain Kessler, as inspiring and courageous as that of Major Logan.
Yes, Grant. The story of Sam Logan is one of my favorites. But there are thousands of others just as good. As a matter of fact, Bob Montgomery and I used to swap a lot of mighty fine stories down there in the New Hebrides.
Do you know Commander Montgomery, who portrayed you this evening?
Indeed, I do. We've spent many an evening visiting in my hut when his cruiser was down in that part of the world. I've gotten quite a chuckle out of sitting here tonight, listening to Bob play me.
I know he's felt it a privilege to do it, Captain Kessler, because he's had an opportunity to see your work at first hand. Now, at just what point do you feel the actual rehabilitation of an amputee should begin?
At the very moment he's hit. That would be the ideal thing. But of course, we know that isn't possible. By the time the boys reach us at Mare Island, they have had their preliminary surgical treatment and also a chance to do a lot of thinking and worrying.
What worries them most?
First of all, they wonder how their wives and sweethearts are going to be affected by their disability. They want to know how their communities will receive them and whether or not they are going to be able to take care of themselves and earn a living.
You can reassure them on all those scores?
Yes, Grant. We do everything possible to help them. And before the patient leaves the hospital, he must be able to dress and undress, feed and shave himself, lock and unlock doors, drive, swim, dance, write, handle a telephone, earn a living. In other words, be a completely self-sufficient person.
That's more than some of them could do before the war.
That's very true. We have found that a majority of our patients did not go beyond the 11th grade in school. Many were in unskilled occupations. We want to do more than restore these men to blind alley jobs, especially now that they are older and somewhat changed by their experiences. Our aim is to use the valuable time of convalescence for education and training, for giving them a chance to find the work they really like and are interested in doing, and then seeing that they return to civilian living better equipped than they ever were to take their place in social and business life.
Thank you, Captain Kessler. And it's easy to see why it gives the boys new hope just to know that they're being routed to you at Mare Island for their new arms and legs and their new start in life.
This is Bob Montgomery. Thank you, Captain Kessler, for the privilege of taking a part which rightfully belongs to you. You know, I've been hoping that we could take up spinning those yarns we started out in the Hebrides, and it looks as if we're going to be able to. I'll be in San Francisco the latter part of the week, and I'll give you a call at Mare Island. See you later, Doctor, and good luck.
Shenley Laboratories, maker of penicillin Shenley, dedicates this program to the 180,000 doctors of our country, 60,000 of whom are with the armed forces, 120,000 of whom are maintaining the health of all of us at home. In closing, Shenley Laboratories leaves you with this thought. In the piece to come, an important part of Shenley policy will be a continuing program of research.
The Doctor Fights, on Tuned to Yesterday from June 6th, 1944 on CBS. A day during the Second World War that, in its own way, will live in infamy. It was on a 50-mile stretch of heavily fortified French coastline that 160,000 Allied troops landed to fight the Nazi Germans on the beaches of Normandy, France, known as D-Day. You are listening to an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. And now the storytelling series with tales from real life called The Passing Parade. In two parts, we'll hear the story of Typhoid Mary with John Nesbitt as host. This episode syndicated for broadcast in the late 1940s.
This is John Nesbitt with another chapter in our Passing Parade. And our review this time will be taken from the medical and legal records which describe a mysterious and terrible woman. After a moment, we come to the story once written in headlines which gave the name of Typhoid Mary to the American Passing Parade. On the reviewing stand, to deal with this somewhat blood-curdling case, I'll have to follow the lines of a detective story, except that I'll try to stick to the facts. This life adventure will take 2 days in the telling, so both this and our next broadcast will be required. For the first clue, we must learn a couple of facts about typhoid fever. Within living memory, this sickness was once rampant everywhere in the United States. Generally speaking, typhoid is a poor man's disease. Where you can afford a good home with cleanliness and pure water and so on, typhoid rarely gets in. So when in the summer of 1900, an epidemic of typhoid burst out in the suburb of New York called Mamaroneck, it was a matter of astonishment to the health department. Yet the children of wealthy parents, playing with their nursemaids on the broad green family lawns, and particularly teenagers, were suddenly burned up with fever and dying. Now up from New York comes a health detective. His name, Dr. George A. Soper. We must remember that name with honor, for he was a very brave man. Yet at Mamaroneck, he failed. The epidemic stopped, and he had nothing to hunt. 2 years passed, and the killer struck again. This time, the epidemics broke out on the estate of the Drayton family at Dark Harbor, Maine, then at Sands Point, at Oyster Bay, and finally Tuxedo Park. And as before, there was only one dim clue, the fact that the bereaved families were rich, cultured people. As the reports flowed in, Dr. Soper held his head in his hands at his desk and muttered, "It is almost as if some diabolical human who hated rich people was traveling about and putting typhoid into the food or water of their children." And that notion, wild as it sounds, held the terrible truth. Yet no case of a human carrier of this disease had ever been listed in the annals of medicine. Up to the great estates, returned Dr. Soper. To every family struck by the illness, he asked these questions. Who were your visitors? Give me a list of their names, a list of the names of your servants, and of everyone entering your house. Then he took these lists and he laid them side by side. Visitors so-and-so and so-and-so, gardener George, coachman Sylvester, cook Mary, second maid Nora, downstairs maid Dora. Family B, visitors so-and-so, gardener Tony, coachman Andrew, cook Mary, downstairs maid Olga. Family C, gardener Stewart, butler Henry, cook Mary, downstairs maid Margaret, second maid Sylvia. He made up a number of these lists, and the instant he set them side by side, he had his answer. One name was on all the lists, the name Mary. Mary Mallon, cook. In all cases, Mary's employers had been sympathetic to her, and when, naturally enough, in a house afflicted by typhoid, she had resigned, they had given her a good bonus and a warm letter of recommendation, and then they buried their children. Now Dr. Soper put a revolver into his pocket, and he went in to make his capture. From the employment agencies, he found Mary Mallon's address. Then, because he was a scientist as well as a manhunter, he took with him a woman doctor named Josephine Baker. He wished to examine Mary Mallon, and out of human consideration, he employed another woman, a woman to do the job. With this woman doctor, he now goes and knocks on the kitchen door of a mansion on New York City's Park Avenue. A woman, about 38 years of age, spotlessly dressed, opens the door. She beams a warm Irish smile. She is sweet-faced, short and plump, with a fine complexion and honest blue eyes. And she stands there, a good cook, proud of her spotless kitchen, holding the screen door open. "And what can I do for you?" Dr. Soper gazes at her a moment. "Your name, I believe, is Mary Mallon." The cook smiles. "Why, sure, Mary Mallon it is." "Then I would like to talk with you, Mary Mallon. I am from the Department of Health." The white-gowned woman at the door stiffens, a frozen expression fixes itself, the blue eyes bulge. Without a word, she lurches back and slams the door. For the first moment in the case of Mary Mallon, there now appears the violence in this woman's nature which would make her one of the notorious headline figures of her day. And we'll continue in a moment with the story of this agent of death in The Passing Parade. This is John Nesbitt following the Mellon case again, which now finds us with Dr. Soper and Dr. Baker standing outside a closed kitchen door. Dr. Josephine Baker reaches for the door and Soper stops her. No, she may be dangerous. Wait. They return a short while later, joined by three policemen, an ambulance, and six interns trained in the use of the straitjacket. Hundreds of people on Park Avenue stop. A crowd forms in front of the mansion. The medical detectives and police burst in and dash through the huge old house. Mary Mellon has disappeared. The searchers ransack the building. And out in a narrow cement service yard, a policeman shoves over a large garbage can. And from it bursts the body of Mary Mellon, doubled up like a trapped wild animal. But again, like an animal, she turns to attack. She lunges at Dr. Baker with a huge cooking fork. But the interns and police close in, and a moment later, Mary Mellon, kicking and shrieking, is carried to the ambulance, snapped into a straitjacket, and tied down to the stretcher. And as the ambulance screams through New York streets, the doctor rides in with Mary Mellon and shoves a needle into her arm and gives the sedative. And Mary's quiet then. She stares up at him. Are you taking me to prison to hang me? The reply of that doctor, who sits looking down sadly at this shackled woman, may astonish you. For he said, why, no, Mary, we're simply taking you to the hospital. Says Mary, weeping suddenly, I didn't kill them children, I didn't. The doctor says, Mary, I think you may carry death around with you without knowing it. Mary looks up. Oh, dear Mother of God, let me die. Let me die. The story of Mary Mellon now becomes a tragedy rather than a mystery story. But as the years go by, it will change again to a sinister drama more concerned with police than with medicine. At the contagious ward of Bellevue Hospital, Mary Mellon's frightful sense of guilt was lifted from her. For upon examination, they found her innocent of deliberate murder. She was a victim of what is fortunately one of the rarest tragedies known to science. Although perfectly healthy herself, she was a human carrier of typhoid. But at least she could now know that she wasn't a murderess. Mary Mellon, it was realized, was a simple-minded and very ignorant woman. She had vaguely sensed that she was connected with the outbreaks of typhoid in the various families. She had nervously quit and moved on, thinking superstitiously that it was some kind of evil luck she brought with her. And that is why, when the doctors first spoke to her, she had flown into such a tantrum. She had one chance, however. By submitting to a rather critical operation, the organ in her body which carried the germs might be removed. But Mary was terrified of doctors, and she flatly refused to submit to the surgeon. And so strongly do American laws guard the rights of the individual that legally this woman could not be operated upon without her consent. So Mary Mellon was given her choice of medical operation or isolation as a prisoner on North Brother Island. Mary chose North Brother Island. This place is a mound of rock covered with buildings, and you can see it from your automobile as you cross the Triborough Bridge on New York's East River. In the year 1907, Mary went to that island. Constantly, she pled for release, and earnest lawyers fought in the courts for her. Finally, on February 19, 1910, this woman, now gray and marked by her long ordeal, although just 43, was brought from the island, and she was set free, for she now gave her solemn oath never to prepare food for others. She had no difficulty about making a living since there was wide sympathy for her, and dozens of jobs were found and offered her which were entirely safe in regard to the public. And as the years went by, from time to time, Mary would drop into the health department and chat cheerfully and in a friendly way with Dr. Josephine Baker and the staff, and she would always thank them for their great understanding. Alas for them, they did not understand her quite well enough. 5 years went by. On February 12th in 1915, an uptown maternity hospital in New York hired a new cook, and the new cook was a dandy. The food was superb, and the patients, who were young mothers with their babies at breast, were delighted with the delicacies that now came up from the kitchen on their trays. And down below in the white hospital kitchen, happy as a lark, was a plump, pleasant-looking woman with a clear complexion and bright blue eyes. The new hospital cook was Miss Mary Mellon. Mary was now in possession of one of those demons that she believed in her superstitious soul. This time, she was possessed by the demon of revenge on all society. In a moment, we'll return to give the footnote for today's edition, in which we will outline the clues to the second part of the story of Mary Mellon in The Passing Parade. Today's footnote permits us to explain that from time to time, when a story seems to require full-scale length, we will devote two programs to the same theme, as here in the case of Mary Mellon. And in the chapter to come, we will follow the most astounding change in her history, by which she became again a trusted and respectable member of the human family. Until we meet again, this is John Nesbitt saying goodbye to you all.
That was part one of the story of Typhoid Mary on the Passing Parade program. Now on to part two with John Nesbitt.
On the reviewing stand again, the terrible career of Typhoid Mary has always intrigued me greatly as I have collected the records about her. Not because it's a very pleasant story, heaven knows, but because of the astounding series of changes that seem to have gone on inside the soul of this woman. As we sketched out for you on the previous chapter, when we began this two-broadcast study of a sensational American melodrama, Mary Mellon was at first an innocent and friendly Irish girl. Hard-working, she was a splendid cook, employed by the best families of New York. She loved her job cooking. She was popular with her employers and a kindly friend to their children. But she killed some of those children. She killed them because she was chosen by destiny to bear one of the rarest afflictions known to science. Her body was a carrier of deadly typhoid fever. A simple, ignorant woman, she had only a dim and dreadful fear that somehow she was connected with these epidemics, since no human typhoid carrier had ever been registered in America before her time. When it was definitely proved that she was indeed America's first recognized carrier of typhoid, the headlines swept the nation, and as Typhoid Mary, she will never be forgotten. Then came the 3 years when she was confined as a prisoner on North Brother Island in New York, refusing to submit to an operation that might have removed the germs from her body. Then came a day when the tormented, not very bright woman at last gave her solemn vow that she would never prepare food for others again, and she was set free. There were 5 full years between 1910 and 1915 when she worked at safe jobs, regularly visited the health department, and cheerfully assured them that knowing she bore death in her hands now, she would never think of being a professional cook again. Then came the unspeakable moment when on February 12, 1915, the newspapers carried the news that a typhoid epidemic had broken out in, of all places, a modern uptown hospital for expectant mothers, that two of these young wives had looked on the faces of their newborn children for only a few hours before dying. Off to that hospital rushed Dr. Josephine Baker, the brilliant woman health officer, to play detective again and find the source of the disease. But this time, she not only tested the water and made the usual investigations, but knowing now that typhoid could be carried by humans who were perfectly healthy, she got the list of nurses and kitchen employees who had recently entered the hospital. The list was carefully checked. Dishwashers, special diet chefs, fry chefs, and the general cook, a Mrs. Brown. Dr. Baker first obtained a careful description of each employee before interviewing them. And when the new cook, Mrs. Brown, was described to her, Dr. Baker dropped her head and held her hand to her eyes in a moment of complete horror, knowing that she had just had a perfect physical description of the human being she had fought against for 12 years and befriended as well. Mrs. Brown, of course, was Mary Mellon, Typhoid Mary. Here was the world's most celebrated carrier of an often fatal disease, a woman who had 100 times fought for her right to be legally free, and who had given her oath never to handle food, not only cooking again, but going to a hospital which specialized in the care of young mothers of infants and asking for a job and going to work. When Dr. Josephine Baker got hold of herself, she picked up the telephone and she called the hospital superintendent. "Well, I have found out the cause of your epidemic. It's all right now. I am going down to find Mrs. Brown, the cook." After a moment, the official answered, "Why, that's wonderful news, doctor, but you'll have to wait a while before talking to the best cook we've had in years, because my schedule here shows that this is Mrs. Brown's day off." And then to herself, Josephine Baker must have said, Mary Mallon knew, she knew. She must have known the instant typhoid appeared that I'd be on her trail, and now she has escaped. Perhaps as a means of tracing the sinister cook quickly, the case was given enormous publicity. It nearly wrecked the reputation of that fine and entirely blameless maternity hospital. But with descriptions out everywhere, Josephine Baker now followed Typhoid Mary's trail step by step across Manhattan and to Long Island. Dr. Baker may have guessed that Mary would have taken work for one of the large and wealthy estates that had been her favorite working places when first her dreadful power to kill had been discovered. But the guess was wrong, for when she caught her, Dr. Baker found that Mary had gone to Corona, Long Island on an errand of mercy. She had heard that an old acquaintance of hers, with whom she had once worked long before, was ill and needed help. So there, by the bedside of her already very dangerously sick friend, they found Mary Mallon. She had arrived earlier, had tended the patient like a loving and professional nurse, and had filled her with dainty invalid dishes cooked by her own lethal hands. At the moment Dr. Baker burst into the room, Typhoid Mary was seated by the friend's bed, feeding her by the spoonful with a gelatin dessert. In the name of everything sacred, Mary, why did you break your oath and do this frightful thing? Said Mary Mallon. Well, I love to cook. And here stands the mystery which was never solved. After a pause, we'll pass along what we know concerning the dark secret in the soul of the agent of death of the passing parade. This is John Nesbitt on the reviewing stand again, and to me, here is one of the most astonishing facts of American justice. The fact that Typhoid Mary was not taken now to the woman's penitentiary at Bedford Hills to await trial for the deliberate murder of the two young mothers whom she had stricken down even as they bore their babies. Instead, on the 17th of March in 1915, she was gently ushered off to North Brother Island again and presented with a private cottage completely furnished and equipped with all the comforts. For those first deaths which came from her envenomed hands, she was not, of course, responsible. But to have returned to cook in a maternity hospital with a careful change of name after 5 years of obedience to the laws of humanity seems to be too sinister an act to be explained by the fact that Mary Mallon was an exceedingly ignorant and dull woman. But no murder charges, so far as I know, were ever brought against her. She steadfastly refused the operation that would have removed her deadly power, and all the laws of New York were walls of iron that guarded this legal right of hers to refuse. Visitors to the island in the years that followed were fascinated when the little cottage was pointed out to them, for Mary Mallon made charming curtains for the windows, covered her chairs with cretonne covers, fixed watercolors to the walls, and all in all, she turned her prison into the perfect picture of a rose-covered cottage. There she would sew, read, and such was the kindness of the health department that she could entertain visitors from time to time. Lots of people befriended her and saw to it that she wasn't too lonely. But even these tender-hearted friends generally got up and went home in a hurry just before dinner time. Sweet and grandmotherly, Mary passed the twilight as a guest of our government, comfortable and amiable. Amiable unless the subject of her isolation came up, in which case she insisted that she was being deeply wronged. And as she sat in her rocking chair, out over the world went the search for the other humans who might be carriers. Nation after nation accepted the medical discoveries that had begun in the United States with the case of Typhoid Mary and passed laws to control it. So tremendous was the publicity given that in every city and state of the country, the cases similar to hers were guarded so the danger to the rest of us is slight. But as Mary Mallon's dark escapades brought about this increase in public safety, the woman herself went into the final change of her life. For out on the island, they found work for her to do in the medical laboratories. Not, of course, work which could result in the contamination of food or drugs. And as a laboratory assistant, with work for her hands, Mary Mallon found peace of soul and even happiness at last. Just as she had once been a superb cook, she now became a fine laboratory worker. And for her final years, every day found her working diligently in connection now with the saving of lives, quite as happy in the laboratory of a scientist as once she had been in the kitchens of New York families. On Christmas Eve in 1932, she suffered from a stroke, and she lived out the last days of her life in the Riverside Hospital. Never for an instant did she show the least regret at having carried typhoid to more than 50 people and causing a number of fatalities. But as she came to her own death on November the 12th in 1938, there was one small sign that perhaps very deeply hidden in her heart, she did have the knowledge that as Typhoid Mary, she had been a destroyer who had struck without mercy. For to her last hour, she never revealed the names and addresses of her mother and father, her brothers and sisters, and it is not known whether they are in America or in the old country, and at least she spared them the knowledge that their blue-eyed child or sister had become Typhoid Mary, symbol of death. In a moment, we'll close with our footnote to this review of The Passing Parade. In today's footnote to the story of Mary Mallon, we should like to state that all typhoid carriers are watched carefully, and they are rare, and they all cooperate for the public safety. Each of them is registered, and whenever an unexplained appearance of typhoid occurs, each is found by a great map of New York, on which each carrier is located by a small flag. Thus, it is scientifically unlikely that a case like Mary Mallon's will ever disturb us again. Time's up. Until our next review, this is John Nesbitt saying goodbye to you all.
The Passing Parade on Tuned to Yesterday, a syndicated recording from the later 1940s. And that wraps up this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's golden years. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Livonier. Thanks for tuning in.